to Blockstars, Ripple's podcast that features leaders and developers in crypto and blockchain to discuss the latest trends, technologies, and the real-world problems being solved. I'm your host, Ripple CTO David Schwartz. This special episode marks the first of a series that covers what it means to be building with confidence on the XRP Ledger, an open-source and decentralized Layer 1 blockchain powered by a global developer community. Today, we'll be exploring the incredible work that has gone into bringing about a landmark ruling that sets XRP, the native digital asset of the XRP ledger, apart as a non-security in the United States. We'll be thinking about the long road that led to this significant outcome, the tireless efforts of the legal team, and what this means for builders and entrepreneurs in the space. I'm extremely pleased to be sitting down with Stu Alderotti, someone I know well and who's worked tirelessly with an impressive team to bring about an outcome that we all knew was going to be true a long time ago. Stu is Chief Legal Officer at Ripple and is best placed to offer insights into one of the most important developments of the year in the space. Welcome to Blockstars, Stu. It's great to have you here.
Great, David. Thanks for having me.
Let's think a little bit about your role at Ripple and what your interest was in joining an organization on the forefront of Web3.
Yeah, so in January, it'll be 5 years since I joined Ripple. And prior to that, I managed my entire career in New York City. That career expanded more than 30 years. The first half of that was with big law in New York. I was with a law firm, worked my way up from associate to partner. I was a litigator and a trial lawyer. And then after doing that for a good long time, I decided to go in-house. And I went the financial services route, first at American Express, where I was managing counsel, and then at HSBC North America Holdings, where I was general counsel, and then lastly at CIT Group, where I was with general counsel. And after doing that a good long time, I was burnt down, and working for big banks is pretty soul crushing. You work long hours. It's really hard, but you don't know really what you're working towards or what you're accomplishing. And I got a call one day from a headhunter, a search firm out of the blue, asking me if I would be interested in this company called Ripple. I didn't know much about blockchain. I didn't know much about crypto other than what I would read in the press. But doing my research into Ripple, super impressed with their mission. It struck me as the only company out there that really was marrying the promise of blockchain and crypto into a real world use case to solve a real world problem, cross-border payments, one that I was very familiar with having worked in traditional finance. The leadership team was very impressive, including you and Brad and others. The board was even more impressive. And here was an opportunity, again, 5 years ago, to get involved in a cutting-edge industry with a cutting-edge legal issue that was really working to develop what the rules of the road should be. And to be a lawyer in that space, to be able to play an integral role and a leading role in developing what those laws and rules ultimately should be, was an opportunity that I really couldn't pass up. So I kind of, you know, gave up everything I knew in New York, all of the network that I had built up over the past 30 years, all of my contacts, and literally and figuratively, you know, got an apartment in San Francisco, moved out there and started this journey. And here we are 5 years on. And I think it didn't pan out exactly as I had hoped, but I think I accomplished what I hoped I would have accomplished in terms of establishing or helping to establish what the rules of the road would be for this industry. Obviously, I would have hoped it would have been an easier path to get to where we got to, but it wasn't. And it's been incredibly exhilarating. And I haven't looked back a moment. It's been great.
So I think it was just a bit over a year that you were here when November, December 2020 rolls around and we get word that the SEC is going to be filing suit against us.
Yeah, so I obviously came in with my eyes wide open. I knew the SEC had opened up an inquiry into Ripple. I had been involved in complex regulatory investigations before, which is probably one of the reasons the company reached out to me. We spent a good long time cooperating with the SEC, meeting with the SEC, trying to educate the SEC. And I had believed, naively so, that eventually we would come to a resolution of whatever was troubling them or what they were concerned about in terms of Ripple and Ripple's use of the digital token XRP and our tech stack. But I eventually learned in December of 2020 that there was no reasonable resolution to be reached with the SEC. And I think it dawned on me kind of late in the process. I'm not sure we would have changed anything if it had dawned on me earlier in the process that this was bigger than Ripple. This was bigger than the digital token XRP. This really was a campaign by the federal government through the SEC to do everything they can to try to bring this industry to heel. And they sued us. I certainly, you know, again, we all hope that that wouldn't be the outcome. We worked mightily hard to try to reach a resolution with them. But once they sued us on December 22nd, 3 days before Christmas, at that point, we were not going to settle for a bunch of reasons we can talk about. In for a penny, in for a pound, at that point, we had no choice but to fight this and fight it as robustly and vigorously and completely as we can. And we said from day one that we were going to do this not only for Ripple's benefit, but we're going to do this for the benefit of the entire industry in the United States. And I'm not sure everyone believed us in December of 2020, but I think here we are in third quarter of 2023. And I think everyone believes us that what we did here was for the greater benefit of the industry in the U.S.
So as I understand that, essentially, the sole allegation in the lawsuit is that XRP is a security that Ripple would have had to register to sell or distribute. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the SEC was really slippery on this point. And if you were to ask them, are you alleging that XRP, the digital asset in and of itself, is a security? Or are you alleging that Ripple's distributions of XRP are investment contracts, the special type of a security, and therefore a security? You wouldn't get a clear answer. And we kept pushing them on this point. Now, I think under the law, we firmly believe that it was only distributions of an asset that could sometimes be contracts for an investment and therefore an investment contract and regulated as a security. And the asset itself is never in and of itself a security. But I think the SEC wanted a much broader reading of the law. And so technically, did they allege that XRP was in and of itself a security? I think they were careful to be as vague as they possibly could be on what it was they were actually alleging. But it was clear that the end game that they were hoping for was a finding that the digital asset XRP was in and of itself a security.
So let's talk about the legal standard for what makes something a security or something an offer of a security. So I've looked at the statute and there's a list of like a whole bunch of things that are securities. And some of them are obvious, like stocks are securities by statute. And then there's this weird term, investment contract. And as I understand cases like this, the allegation is that XRP is, or that offers of XRP are offers of an investment contract or investment contracts, which is about as clear as mud. So what's an investment contract?
So you're right. Under the 1933 Securities Act, which gives the SEC jurisdiction to regulate things called securities, there's a list of things that are deemed to be securities. And within that list are traditional things that you would ordinarily think of, like a share of stock or a debenture or a note, things that an issuer, when they issue, are making promises to the purchaser. And then the purchaser has rights against the issuer. So with a traditional share of stock, if I were to issue a traditional share of stock in Stoop Company and you were to buy it as a shareholder, you would always have rights against Stoop Company, and Stoop Company would always have obligations to you, no matter how you bought that share of stock and no matter who holds that share of stock. That share of stock always represents a bundle of rights and obligations. So that is a traditional share of stock. When you get down the long list of things that are security at the end or towards the end, there is something called an investment contract. So what's an investment contract? So an investment contract is a contract for an investment, which sounds sort of painfully obvious, but that's what it is. So in other words, if I enter into an enterprise with you, so you're not investing in Stew Company, but Stew Company is going to say, hey, look, I've got a bunch of chinchillas that I can sell to you. But rather than you taking possession of the chinchillas, I'm going to keep those chinchillas on my chinchilla farm. I'm going to feed them. I'm going to get them nice and fat. I'm going to, you know, skin them, and then I'm going to sell the chinchilla furs to furriers. And when I do that, I'm going to distribute the profits out to you. That's a contract for an investment, because what you did is you bought that contract from me, but you didn't really buy the asset. You bought the asset plus that bundle of promises that I was going to do things on your behalf to generate a profit and then distribute those profits back to you. That's an investment contract.
So we have this long line of cases where people sold things that were clearly not securities in and of themselves. Things like orange groves, whiskey, cask receipts, beavers, all these strange things, and where the SEC or another litigant alleged that they were being offered as an investment contract because there was some arrangement on top of just the ordinary sale of that item.
That's right. The seminal case is the Howey case, the 1946 Supreme Court case, where the SEC sued a orange grove cooperative in Florida called Howey in the Hills. And what Howey in the Hills did was they had a bunch of tourists from, you know, New York and New Jersey, a bunch of dentists and doctors, you know, when they were down there. And they said, hey, look, we can sell you a strip of our orange grove. You actually buy the real estate. And in combination, you can go back to New York or New Jersey and, you know, continue your dental or your medical practice. And what we're going to do is we're going to combine the strip of land that you own, and we're going to plant the orange groves, cultivate them, water them, fertilize them, pick the oranges, sell the oranges. And then to the extent that we generate profit, we'll distribute those profits back to you. And what the court found was that the orange groves themselves were nothing more than a land contract, but the orange groves combined with that bundle of promises to do all those other managerial things to generate a profit from those orange groves and then deliver the profits back, that was the investment contract. And that investment contract is what's subject to the SEC's jurisdiction. But the sliver of land that I bought is always just a sliver of land.
So it's been 2.5 years. Were there some moments where you kind of felt really frustrated? Were there moments where you felt like we were making progress?
It was a hard journey. It was an extremely frustrating journey. The government does not play fair, which is unfortunate. As a lawyer, you would expect more. And as an American citizen, quite frankly, you would expect more. But the government, this government, at least in this SEC, the process is the punishment. And they make it as painful and as long and as expensive and as punitive as they possibly can. So that's frustrating. I mean, just to put it in perspective, you go back to that Howey case from 1946. From the time the Howey case was just filed at the trial court to the time it was decided in the Supreme Court, I think it was only 18 months. So it went through the trial court, it went through the appellate court, it went through the Supreme Court. Howey in the Hills and the SEC, they just stipulated to what the facts were, and they put it in front of the judge and said, what's a ruling? Here, the SEC has no interest in sort of getting to a ruling. What they want to do is punish a litigant, and certainly punish a litigant who decides to fight the government. So it was extremely frustrating. The SEC was not taking consistent positions with the court. The court at one point even found that the SEC was acting in a hypocritical fashion and simply staking out positions to advance litigation as a litigation tactic rather than following a faithful allegiance to the law. That's frustrating, whether litigating against a bottom-feeding plaintiff lawyer. It's certainly frustrating when the government is behaving that way. When I started to have some hope, some glimmer of hope in all of this, is we were in front of a court and a judge that started to see through what the SEC was doing and started to push back on the SEC and started to curtail a lot of what the SEC was trying to do and give us a lot of what we were asking for. So again, you never know whether you're going to win or lose a case until the outcome. But we were winning a lot of the battles along the way, discovery battles and whatnot, that certainly indicated to me that the SEC's lack of credibility with the court was being exposed. And as a litigator and doing this for as long as I have, judges care about credibility. When you put something in a brief or you stand up in front of a court and you're making an argument, the judge has to believe what you're saying. She can certainly go in and verify the cases and what you're citing, and you know, their law clerks can do the research, but are you being candid with the court? What you're telling the court, does it have a solid grounding in the facts and the law? We were very consistent all throughout the case, and I cannot say the same for the SEC. And I think at the end of the day that the SEC suffered.
You know, I noticed that same thing play out in the court of public opinion, both in the press and in the industry, even before the ruling. I think in the early days, people just assumed, because the SEC had been going after a lot of bad actors in the space, because you and I think we both agree that there's a lot of bad actors and outright scams in the space, and the SEC has gone after certainly some of them. And I think the perception at first was that the SEC wouldn't have filed this suit if they didn't have something tangible. And then over the next couple of months, as the case played out, people were looking people were following the case very closely. People were announcing every time new briefs came, they were looking and they're like, where's the meat of the case? Certainly if there were bad things that the SEC could have said, they would have had every incentive to find them. And I think the industry changed. The SEC also attacked other people who are perceived as good actors in the space. And, you know, the court started a pushback. And I think even before the judgment, there was a very tangible change in the perception of the case in the media and in the industry.
That's exactly right. I think when the case was just filed, and it's always important to note that there were no allegations of fraud in the SEC's case against Ripple, no allegations of market manipulation, no allegations of consumer harm, no allegations of traditional bad acts that people, I think, associate with some of the bad actor crypto stories that have played in the press. This was a pure technical issue of, is a digital asset or the distribution of a digital asset a contract for an investment and therefore a security? But when we were first sued in December of 2020, you're right. A lot of people, I think probably most people, felt that, hey, look, this is the government. The government doesn't file a lawsuit unless they think they're right. They must be right. Ripple must be wrong. And there was a perception relatively quickly, I would say within, you know, 3-4 months, that perception started to change. And there's a number of things that contributed to that. I think one, we have a fantastic comms team, and I think the comms team seized the opportunity to make sure that we were getting our message out. Again, the SEC sued us on December 22nd of 2020, and we came out with a press release on December 21st, the day before, announcing to the world that they were going to sue us. And then we seized the public narrative and we seized the public communication piece of this, and we never let up. And I think that started to gain traction. You combine that with the SEC starting to suffer some early losses in the court on some of these early battles that we were having. And all of a sudden, the SEC is appearing fallible, not infallible. And then this amazing community forms on Twitter, where, as you said, where people were posting news about filings real time with the court. I mean, we've got an incredibly well-paid and talented army of outside lawyers. But most of the time, I was finding out about developments in the case from Twitter, because Twitter was posting those developments in the case. There was another individual who started posting long-form videos every time that there were filings in the case. A video was posted where he would dissect the different arguments and give his view. For the most part, it was spot on. And then, of course, there were others who were out there saying, hey, look, the SEC, to the extent they're purporting to represent and protect retail holders of crypto, they're not. And I represent the retail holders of crypto, and the retail holders of crypto are telling you that the SEC is hurting us. So I think the combination of all of that, the combination of the truth coming out in the legal proceeding, the combination of our own comms team sort of seizing the narrative and never letting up, and the combination of this organic support coming up through the community, principally on Twitter, I think all of that combined really developed some incredible momentum in the case. I mean, when we would get on, and this was still COVID early on, when we would get on the phone with the judge to argue a motion, I think the first time we did that, the judge, the phone line could allow for 500 participants to call in, and it was maxed out instantaneously. And then eventually it was like 5,000 participants can call in, and then that would get maxed out. So the judge is not immune to that. The judge realizes, wow, this case has is getting a lot of attention. And again, maybe what the government is telling me is not something that I need to take at face value, and I need to pressure test. And again, all of that combined, I think, led to the result that we got.
So let's talk about that result, the summary judgment ruling. I remember I was at the office when it came out, and I got a text message on my phone from Brad that just said, "We won." You know, it's long. It's not a two-word ruling by any stretch of the imagination. It's long and complicated, and it took us some time to digest it. What was your experience like when that happened?
Summary judgment is, after 2.5 years of discovery, where you take a fact discovery and you take expert discovery, both the SEC on the one hand and Ripple on the other filed what's called the summary judgment motion with the court, where both sides say, "Hey, look, Judge, the facts really are not in dispute. Here are the facts, and you can decide this as a matter of law." And that's called the summary judgment motion. So that was all filed. I think the final briefs went in probably in November of 2022. And once the briefs go in, you have no idea when the judge is going to rule, and you get no advance notice of when the judge is going to rule. When the ruling hits the public docket real time, that's when you and the rest of the world know that there's a ruling. So on July 13th, which is the day the ruling came out, I was in Toronto. I was visiting our Toronto office. And before I went to the office, I had to take a conference call with some of my colleagues at Ripple. And I was sitting on a park bench, I would say 6-7 blocks away from the office. And I'm on the conference call. I have my headphones on from my cell phone. And all of a sudden, this little whirlwind, like literally a whirlwind of wind in front of me, stirs up, and this trash, like this little tornado thing of trash, starts to like swirl in front of me. And I remember I'm watching it. I'm thinking, that's odd. I wonder if that's like a sign or something. That's literally what's going through my mind. And then moments later, my colleague on the phone says, "Stu, Twitter's saying that a decision had come out."
You found that on Twitter?
Yeah, on Twitter. I picked it up on Twitter. So I don't even say goodbye. I hit disconnect on my phone. I pull up my email, and sure enough, my outside lawyers are sending me the decision. Brad, of course, is texting me, and I said, "Brad, give me 10 minutes. I need to get back to the hotel." So I call an Uber. I get back to the hotel, and I pull up the PDF on my phone. It's 34 pages. And as a lawyer, you know, you read a decision from the back to the front, because the last page is when the judge tells you how she's ruled. So I read it, and I get to the hotel. We get on a conference call with Brad and Chris Larson and others. And I'm going to date myself here, but it reminds me of the Bush Gore Supreme Court hearings when the decision came out, and all of the CNN analysts were like in front of the Supreme Court and like trying to real time going through the decision and trying to explain it to America. So I'm on the phone with these guys, and I'm like, "Guys, I think we won mostly what's important." And then Brad emails the company, "We won." And I had not even read all of the 34 pages yet. And then the next thing I know, we had to get on a big town hall video with the entire company. Everyone's popping champagne. And I still haven't read the darn thing. But I still felt pretty confident that we had won. And we could talk about what that meant in a moment, what it means to win. And then after that, our comms team set up for Brad and me, I think it's not an exaggeration, 12 back-to-back media interviews with the Journal and the Times and the Post and Reuters and Bloomberg and some of the crypto rags, just back to back to back. And I still had not read this thing. I'm like reading it real time as we go through and trying to educate the reporters who were getting a lot of things wrong. And at this point, everyone's like, "Oh, you're going to go out, you're going to celebrate, you're going to have dinner." But I got to tell you, it was like 9 o'clock at night at this point. I guess the decision, I forget when the decision came through. It probably came through 11:30 or 12 in the afternoon. And I said, look, I'm just going to go back to the hotel. And I got back to the hotel about 10 o'clock and I read the decision from beginning to end. And
finally got a chance to
read the decision. And it's a good decision. I think the judge got right what she needed to get right. And the more I read the decision, the more nuanced the decision is. In other words, the judge decided just what she needed to decide it and no more. And we could talk about what that ruling was, but it is a landmark ruling. It's a very, very important ruling. I think it exposes a crack or a fissure in the SEC's campaign of regulation by enforcement. It completely destroys this narrative that all tokens are securities. It completely destroys the narrative that the law is clear. Everybody should have known what the law was. And great for Ripple, and I think even better for the industry in the U.S.
So I know it's difficult to summarize 50-plus pages, but how would you summarize the most important?
So I think the most important part of the ruling is that XRP, the digital asset, is not in and of itself an investment contract and therefore not security. And the judge says that as clearly as I've just stated it. And that is really important because, as I said earlier, the SEC wanted to establish that a digital asset can be something called a crypto asset security, and the asset itself, like the orange groves or the beavers or the casks of whiskey, are themselves securities, and she would have none of it. That's the law of the land. That's unassailable. I don't even think the SEC would ever think about appealing that because they would be wrong. And I think that is the statement that Ripple needed, and that is the statement that the industry needed. She went further, and she found that certain distributions of XRP are not securities. So, for example, the trading of XRP on secondary market crypto asset platforms, where the buyer doesn't know who the seller is and the seller doesn't know who the buyer is, it's simply a blind bid-ask spot market trade. She said, those are not contracts for investments because, number one, a buyer is not relying on the seller in any way, shape, or form because the seller and the buyer doesn't even know who the seller was. That's really important. And within hours of the decision, every major exchange in the U.S. and Canada relisted XRP for trading. It had been suspended from trading since the time the lawsuit was filed in December of 2020. She also found that to the extent Ripple gave away XRP to developers for developer grants or charities, those also were not contracts for investment because even the very first prong, the very first requirement in investment of money is absent. If I'm giving something away to a developer or I'm giving something away for charitable purposes, the receiver is not making an investment of money. She also found that using XRP in part for compensation is not an investment contract because if I go to work or you go to work for Ripple and part of our compensation is to be paid in XRP, that's simply part of our compensation. In other words, we're not investing in XRP by coming to work and having part of our compensation paid in XRP. So all of these were very, very important. And that's the law of the land. And I think these all really destroyed the SEC's narrative in terms of what they were trying to say. She did find that some earlier distributions of XRP from 2013 to 2020 that were embodied in a contract between Ripple as the seller and an institutional as a buyer of the XRP had attributes of an investment contract. And she found that those were investment contracts. But we can live with that because that's looking in the rearview mirror. But I think looking forward, we got all of the clarity that we needed and we wanted.
I think the community and the industry got that too. I think there were a lot of projects that were hesitant to use XRP or the XRP ledger, both because of the sort of cloud of uncertainty and, of course, the delisting making it difficult for people in the United States to get access to XRP. Those obstacles are gone now. And so now I think there's a new wave of opportunity for enterprise users and community users to adopt the XRP ledger for DeFi and finance applications, you know, for things like real-world asset tokenization and so on. I think there's still stuff for Ripple to fight over, but I think the community isn't at risk anymore. And I think there also, prior to the ruling, there were a lot of people in the community and enterprises who were kind of on hold, both because they were concerned about whether or not XRP was inherently a security. And of course, there was the difficulty of people in the United States to get XRP with the exchanges. So there are still those issues for Ripple left about those early sales. But I do think that this ruling really, for the community and for enterprises in the United States, I think this kind of settles the battle for them. There were issues for adoption of the XRP ledger, whether XRP was inherently a security and whether people in the United States could get their hands on XRP. You know, the exchange delistings made it very difficult for people to get XRP.
Yeah, I don't think it's an exaggeration. I think it's a factual statement that with the exception of Bitcoin, XRP in the United States is the only digital asset that has clarity now that it is not a security. This SEC under this commissioner has even expressed doubts as to whether they'd be willing to concede that as to Ethereum. But with this court ruling, which again, I think is unassailable, that clarity is now enjoyed by XRP and Bitcoin.
I think that opens up a wave of opportunity for both enterprise and community adoption. Institutions that need regulatory clarity can adopt technologies like the XRP ledger now without having to worry about whether XRP is inherently a security.
Absolutely.
I think this ruling might also help to enable central banks to participate more confidently in CBDC projects and stablecoins around the XRP ledger technology. Those are some of the most conservative institutions in the world. And, you know, dealing with a company and a platform that has a regulatory cloud hanging over it might be a bit of a blocker for them. Ripple's already built a business using XRP in its payment solution as a bridge currency, enabling global financial institutions to use blockchain technology for financial use cases. And there are many examples of companies building blockchain-based businesses that could now expand and evolve further. Companies like Futureverse, working with brands like Visa and Ducati to build tokenization strategies on the XRP ledger. Companies like Homecoin and Proper Home, building mortgage-backed stablecoins and tokenizing real estate. Companies like Fractal ID and Heirloom, building digital identity businesses on the XRP ledger. This ruling could deliver the clarity that they need to continue to expand and evolve.
Yeah. Well, first, maybe I'll start that by looking outside of the U.S. And the U.S. is uniquely situated here in a negative way in the way they have approached the question of how to regulate crypto. They really have ceded this to one regulator in the U.S., the SEC, that has expressed extreme hostility, irrational hostility at this point. Outside of the U.S., we have rational regulatory and licensing frameworks. Ripple has offices in Singapore and London and Ireland and Dubai and Sao Paulo. And we work closely with regulators in all of those jurisdictions to make sure we have the appropriate permissions and the appropriate oversight to conduct our business. So I think the SEC's lawsuit was somewhat irrelevant when we thought about building our business outside of the U.S., although it was always out there. I think having that behind us, we have tremendous momentum in all of those jurisdictions outside the U.S. that I've mentioned. And I think with the SEC ruling now, that momentum is just going to be accelerated and supercharged. In the U.S., I think that the SEC, when they sued Ripple, a lot of people thought that was going to be an outlier, as we talked about earlier. In December 2020, Ripple must have done something wrong. The SEC has to be right. What the SEC has shown is they're willing to sue anybody and everybody, even going so far as to suing Coinbase, a publicly traded company that the SEC had to approve their public filing. And our ruling is clearly going to play a role in these other lawsuits. And in fact, if you read the briefs in these other lawsuits, in many ways, they track the arguments that we've made. And we have no problem with that, because in this case, imitation is the highest form of flattery. It means that the arguments we made are not only right, but they're being endorsed by some of the other smartest law firms and lawyers that are out there. And I think the SEC judges are starting with our judge, but judges are starting to question the SEC's motivations here. We see not only our victory, but we see the victory in the Grayscale ETF case, where a panel of judges said that the SEC was acting arbitrarily and capriciously. Our case, where we have a judge saying that the SEC was acting hypocritically and not faithfully following the law. We'll see what happens in the Coinbase case. But I think that these victories by the industry and these losses by the SEC really signals both to litigants that you can fight, that the SEC is not infallible. In fact, they are very fallible. And it also signals to courts that the SEC is probably wrong here, that they're not winning. The SEC likes to hold out settlements, and they have hundreds and hundreds of settlements as victories. Settlements are not victories. Settlements are just they beat their opponent into either bankruptcy or surrender. But those aren't victories. And what we've shown is when the SEC is challenged in a court of law and they're put to the proofs, their proofs, they have the burden of proof, they fail. And I think that has given a tremendous wind in the backs of the industry in the United States that to keep fighting. And ultimately, what we want is not a bunch of federal judges around the country beating the SEC pack, although that's a great thing. What we ultimately want is a policy solution in the U.S., but I think the SEC losing in the courts also give policymakers, meaning legislatures, representatives in Congress and senators, the courage to say, hey, chairman of the SEC, you come before us repeatedly testifying that the laws are clear, and this industry is filled with a bunch of hucksters and fraudsters who don't want to follow the law. But it seems to me that courts are agreeing with them and disagreeing with you. So I don't think what you've been telling us is true. And having those policymakers start to push back on the SEC, I think is a good thing as well. And hopefully eventually, it takes a long time, but eventually will lead to some good comprehensive policy frameworks.
So I always ask my guests to get out their crystal balls and make some predictions. The United States could have been a leader in cryptocurrency and crypto policy globally. They've given up that role. So who are the winners? Who are going to be those leaders? What jurisdictions do you see winning at the U.S. expense?
I think the U.K. is going all in on not only this industry, but all financial technology. They're being very proactive. There was a visit by an exchequer from Parliament to San Francisco just last week, where he stated he wants London to be the new Silicon Valley. Singapore, of course, has been very, very proactive. Dubai's been very proactive. And I think the EU passing what's known as MiCA, their comprehensive legislative framework. So I think all of those places are seizing the advantage. The thing about the US is they did lose a great opportunity here. Crypto, as you know better than me, I'm a lawyer, but you're one of the geniuses who kind of can build this stuff. Crypto is a technology. Crypto is not going away. The technology that underlies it is not going away. It can't be regulated out of existence. And I think what we're going to have here is we're going to continue to see this technology build out outside of the U.S., the U.S. losing ground. And in, you know, pick a year, 2030, 2035, we're going to have to bring crypto back to the U.S. legislation where the U.S. is going to say, oh, God, we missed the boat, and now we've got to make this big investment. I hope policymakers will get there sooner rather than later. Again, we're starting to see some good comprehensive efforts, and we spent a lot of time in Washington. But to get something done in Washington is a heavy, heavy lift. But for the moment, I'm a big believer in checks and balances, and checks and balances for the moment are working, and the courts are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Huge thank you to you, Stu. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, but it's a special pleasure hosting you on Ripple's podcast, Blockstars.
Oh, thank you, David. I always love catching up with you.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me on Twitter at Joel Katz, J-O-L-K-A-T-Z. And you can follow Stu at S_Alderoty, A-L-D-E-R-O-T-Y. And remember to follow at RippleXDev on Twitter to keep up with the latest industry news, technical updates, and cool new developer projects in the community. See you around the blockchain.